As the images of the city of Raqqa graced the screens of our telly and computers, it became all too clear that the victory over ISIS there last month had come at a huge cost. The city has been reduced to rubble, most residents having fled long ago, and no sooner had the small celebrations finished than the former capital of ISIS was no longer under their control. The questions about what next had begun. Where would ISIS rise up? Or what extremist organisation would rise in its place? The problems that gave rise to ISIS haven't gone away, and there's also the question of what will happen to the Kurds that were so critical to that victory in Raqqa. Now, to find out whether there's any hope amongst the embers, we're pleased to have Jason Burke on the line from South Africa. Jason is currently the Africa correspondent for The Guardian, author of several books on extremist organisations in the Middle East, including his most recent, The New Threat. Jason, welcome.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
The nominal capital of Raqqa, the last stronghold, has fallen. Does this mean that ISIS has fallen as well?
Yes, to an extent. There's a lot of debate over what we should be saying about the battles in Raqqa and more recently in Deir ez-Zor, which is a smaller town just to the east of Raqqa, a bit further on the Euphrates. Which was also a stronghold of ISIS. That's now fallen too. So I think that the question is really, and it goes to the heart of what ISIS is, the question is really, now that ISIS has lost the major urban strongholds that it had seized from early or mid-2014 and then held until relatively recently, what is left of ISIS? Was it a territorial project or was it a ideological project? And the answer to that is it was both. There was a strong territorial component and there was a strong ideological component too. And clearly you can destroy the territorial hold, destroying the ideological hold is a much more troublesome undertaking. So I think
Jason,
I discover
from you, and I've never quantified the death toll, but ISIS have lost 60,000 fighters since 2014.
Well, that's what the Americans say. It seems a plausible figure. Quite who you're defining as an ISIS fighter or otherwise within that total is open to some debate, but I think that's roughly, I mean, we can say several tens of thousands. Several tens of thousands of people fighting for ISIS have died or been killed. And there was one particular battle in Kobani about 18 months ago now on the Turkish-Syrian border, which was seen as critical. ISIS were fighting largely Kurdish forces and lost a very large number of fighters. And that was the kind of attritional battle that marked the turning point in some ways of the ISIS expansion and the ISIS territorial project, the new caliphate that they declared in Mosul at the end of June 2014.
Well, let the record show that at their heights they controlled over 8 million people and just under 100,000 square miles. I understand they've now retreated to the Euphrates area between Iraq and Syria.
Yeah, largely. I mean, the number of people is much more important than the superficial size of the land, if you like, that they control, because the land was, a lot of it was desert. But the people is important, 7 or 8 million. I mean, that's a pretty sizable state. They could tax those people. They could loot from them. They could do all sorts of things with the resources in that area. It made them probably the best armed, best funded jihadi group. In fact, without a doubt, the best armed, best funded jihadi group we've ever seen. And as near as we've had to a jihadi state as such. And they're now reduced to where they started, really, which is Western Iraq, the Sunni areas of Western Iraq, up the Euphrates Valley, somewhere where I accompanied US troops over a decade ago on their efforts to try and clear that valley of Sunni jihadi militants. So we're sort of back to where we were about a decade ago.
How many fighters are still active, do you think? Have many of them taken the opportunity to go home, wherever that might be?
Best guess is a few thousand. But the thing about ISIS is, like all jihadi organizations, you always had a hard core of very committed people, some of whom might well be foreigners who inducted into a local organization. And then you also had a large number of local auxiliaries, if you like, people who live in and around the places where ISIS were active and eventually conquered, controlled, who joined for reasons that may not be strictly ideological. They may not be fully committed to the cause, but they are loyal to a particular tribe of which the tribal leader has decided to throw in his lot with ISIS and has promised ISIS, 600 fighters. They may be one village fighting another village, and they are joining ISIS because the other village has joined the opposing side. There may be all sorts of reasons that those fighters are involved. So if you're looking at a hard core of fighters, it's probably a couple of thousand. Certainly a very large number have defected or put their AKs under their mattresses, as it were. And there were at its height a large number of foreign fighters, most of them from the Middle East, some from Central Asia, some indeed from Europe and further afield in the West, and a lot of them are dead. Some of them have come home, and a lot are currently unaccounted for.
Well, some of them may be coming home to the UK, of course, where an estimated 850 foreign fighters would be perhaps seeking to return. So British commentators are talking about the fall of Raqqa leading to a rise in terrorist attacks in the UK and in throughout the West.
Yeah, although when you look closely at what they're saying, it's a little bit less clear than that. Andrew Parker is the head of MI5, the Domestic Intelligence Service, certainly signalled what he said called a dramatic upshift in Islamic terrorist threat, if not attacks, in the coming months and years. That's largely to be expected. That's what heads of security services do pretty systematically. Not very many of them go around saying, actually, we're on top of this, there isn't much of a threat. But he was pointing at something that he felt was a genuine phenomenon, and people within the security services tell me they're certainly worried about. What he didn't say was that threat was down to people coming back from Iraq or Syria. And in fact, he was specific about that and said we haven't actually seen the influx yet of those fighters. We still don't quite know where they are or what they're doing. And it's also worth pointing out that even though we've had a series of attacks in the UK this year, none of those have actually involved returning ISIS fighters. In fact, none of them have actually involved anyone who's had direct jihadi experience overseas, with the possible exception of the Manchester bomber who spent some time in Libya with his family and may have come up against ISIS people there, though we're not sure about that yet.
In fact, quite a lot of opportunistic branding of events as ISIS by people who have very, very tenuous connections.
Absolutely, as we saw in New York the other week, and as we've seen systematically over recent months in Barcelona and elsewhere, the links are tenuous. Indeed, in some cases, they don't exist at all. So we think that from the 54-year-old Khalid Massoud, who drove a truck across Westminster Bridge in March and then stabbed a policeman to death, having injured a dozen or so people and killed six or eight, I think. He has no link to ISIS or anyone else, as far as the security services have found in a seven-month investigation. So you have a situation where there is certainly a threat from returning foreign fighters to the West, but in a sense, there is already a threat, and it's one that's based, as you say, on the brand, if you like, and the attraction of that brand.
Well, that brand was very, very extensively marketed through social media. Is the network still pumping out propaganda?
No, it's not. If you take the propaganda about governance, which nobody really looked at because we were all looking at the very nasty videos of extreme violence or the combat footage and stuff like that that was coming out of ISIS. Not many people looked at the governance stuff, which was showing what a wonderful place the Islamic State was for family and for working and all this kind of thing, and how well run it was. That actually was the largest proportion of the propaganda output. That was down by about a third earlier this year, by two thirds in the middle of the year, and in mid-September it just stopped. So the propaganda output has effectively stopped. The point about the social media was not just that the social media existed, Facebook and Twitter and so forth. It was about the delivery onto people's smartphones. It's more the fact that the smartphones exist everywhere, so ISIS could get this stuff to people all over the place. Even people who can't afford a laptop, they could just pick it up on their phone. So the delivery was very important. And now clearly that still exists as a channel and could be exploited by someone else. And obviously the social media is as widespread as it's ever been. So the propaganda is down, certainly. And I mean, I think that ISIS have I differ from some analysts here, that ISIS have taken a really very substantial hit. The caliphate was very important to their brand. That failed. The attraction of the caliphate to a lot of people in the West was significant. And now that ISIS aren't the biggest, baddest gang around, as one former ISIS recruit described them to me in Belgium, actually, after the attacks in France and Belgium a couple of years ago. Now that that's gone, now that they can't claim that kind of supremacy, they haven't got the caliphate, they haven't got the territory and the tanks and everything that went with it, then that attraction is much lesser. Other people disagree, though.
Who can claim the credit for the situation? Needless to say, Donald Trump's tweets are doing so.
Erroneously, largely, although politicians do that. The thing about Islamic militancy is that it has certain inherent flaws within it that mean that it's always going to fail, or it's never quite going to reach the level that its protagonists hope it's going to reach. They're never going to be as successful as they want. One of those is that simply people, most people in the Muslim world, just don't like it, don't want it, aren't interested in it. Maybe there's some components that have a certain attraction in some circumstances, but on the whole, people don't want to be involved in violent, puritanical, intolerant societies and communities such as that the Islamists offer. The second point is that they have to continually expand, and the Islamic State had to continually expand. Once it had basically conquered the Sunni areas of Iraq and Syria that had no proper governance, it got stuck, it stopped. And once that forward momentum was lost, then it was always going to roll back. The third element is that once you take on the West, you're going to be in trouble. And Al-Qaeda learned this to their detriment when they launched attacks in 1998 and then 2001 and subsequently, which we all remember, or some of us are old enough to, in East Africa and then on New York and Washington. That provoked a massive response, which cleared them out of Afghanistan and fundamentally weakened the organization. Similarly, ISIS were launching attacks, certainly planning attacks, long before the West woke up to the threat. So they were planning attacks in the early 2014 against France and elsewhere. It was only in 2015, 16, and really this year, that the certainly last year and this year, that the counter effort really got together and started making a significant difference in rolling back ISIS. But the point being that once you take on the West, which is what ISIS were always going to do, you're going to be in trouble. Now, after that, with all the inherent weaknesses of Islamic militancies, all it takes is for a fairly coherent set of policies to be put in place, a strategy to be put in place, and you will win. So that entailed putting the Iraqi army back together, giving it some new equipment, motivating enough of it, sorting out enough of the local politics for new combatants to be brought to the front, if you like, in Syria, and that was the Kurds, largely, from YPG, who are effectively linked to a very complicated situation involving some hard left organizations which are designated terrorists by locals, which caused local states, particularly Turkey, which caused many problems. But basically, you need to get the politics lined up, you need to get strategy in place, and then start pushing hard using the military superiority that the West has. And that combination of Western military superiority and local funding for local forces is an effective one. We saw that in Afghanistan. We've seen that elsewhere. Effective up the point, but it still does the job.
Jason, we were talking about marketing earlier. Is there a marketing opportunity now for Al-Qaeda? Because the son of Osama has called for revenge for his father's death with timing that seems opportune. Is there a vacancy now for a re-energized Al-Qaeda?
Yeah, that's a very good point. Al-Qaeda never went away. Al-Qaeda was always there. It suffered a massive loss when Osama bin Laden, its founder and leader, was killed in 2011 in a US Special Forces raid on a compound in northern Pakistan, where bin Laden had been hiding for about 5 years. That was a major loss. His successor is Ayman al-Zawahiri, who is in his... Now, he was born in 54, so he's 60-ish, and he's elderly, he's not very charismatic, he has a very pedantic and tedious way of public speaking. And that's all held Al-Qaeda back. They've also just been less high-profile deliberately. They're not seeking to do these spectacular attacks on the West. In fact, they're not seeking at the moment to attack the West at all, it seems. They're looking to build land, territory, support above all in places like the Sahel, the Sahara region of Africa, in Eastern Africa, in Yemen, to an extent in South Asia, elsewhere. And they've been quite successful at slowly building that and maintaining a powerful network of individual groups around the world or the Islamic world. So they're still there. What they've lacked is anything that would rival the ISIS caliphate, which was pretty spectacular, and has now gone. And they've also lacked a really effective, charismatic leader, as they once had in Osama bin Laden. And as you absolutely rightly point out, they've now found Hamza bin Laden, who is his dad's 10th son and is in his late 20s now, and has pretty much all it takes to be at least a good front man. We don't know if he's a strategist. We don't know if he's got any brains. We don't know if he has his father's way with words and ability to talk in a way that's convincing to some people. But he's certainly got the look. And he's been increasingly pushed forward, as you say, as a kind of brand leader for Al-Qaeda. And he's got significant potential there. Now, he may not, there are lots of other people around him, senior people who have got the experience, who've got the organizational know-how and the capabilities and so forth. So it doesn't really matter that he's pretty much untested. But he's there and he's being used more and more, and he could certainly spearhead a renaissance, if you like, a resurgence of Al-Qaeda in the future.
Jason, it's been a privilege to have you on the program. Thank you for your time. Jason Burke, currently the Africa correspondent for The Guardian. As I said earlier, the author of a number of significant books on extremist organizations. The new one is called The New Threat, The Past, Present and Future of Islamic Militancy, and it's published by New Press, another of our stings. And then it's Bernd Brunner talking about bird mania. That's Alice Coltrane, and the track is Ptah, P-T-A-H, which is one of the Egyptian gods, Ptah the Eldad.